is this little act that I've often thought about since. It was a small thing, a tiny act of conscientiousness. He had seen something about her that worried him. He had also taken the measure of me on morning rounds. And what he saw was a fourth-year student with a residency spot already lined up in general surgery on his last rotation of medical school. Did he trust me? No, he did not.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, Atul Gawande reads from Better, which in characteristic understatement, he describes as just a book of medical stories. What Gawande doesn't say is that his medical stories are those of an accomplished surgeon and supremely insightful guide to the arcane world of medical practice. The essays in this book are knit together by Gawande's view that good enough is far short of where we should be, in medicine and in life. Gawande, who often picks up his pen between operations, is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a contributor to the New England Journal of Medicine. He published his first book, Complications, on how doctors learn an imperfect and ever-changing craft while he was still a resident. Complications was a National Book Award finalist in 2002, but it took a MacArthur Genius Fellowship in 2006 for some of his surgical colleagues to see his writing as more than a hobby. It turns out, surprisingly enough, that the secret to doing better isn't more research or new technology. It's finding ways for doctors to make better use of the knowledge they already have. This reading of Better took place in April 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you all for coming out. I want to start with an apology for the fact that I'm leaving right at the end here. But also a special thanks for just so many of you coming out. I've been trying ever since I finished my training and then joined the faculty about 3 years ago as a surgeon to understand what does it mean to be something more than just competent at what we do. And what it led me towards are stories that helped me to see medicine as a kind of performance. And it's easiest to read a little bit from the very beginning to you to give you an idea of what I mean by that. So from the introduction. Several years ago, in my final year of medical school, I took care of a patient who has stuck in my mind. I was on an internal medicine rotation, my last rotation before graduating. The senior resident had assigned me primary responsibility for three or four patients. One was a wrinkled 70-something-year-old Portuguese woman who had been admitted because, well, I'll have to use the technical term here, she didn't feel too good. Her body ached. She had become tired all the time. She had a cough. She had no fever. Her pulse and blood pressure were fine, but some laboratory tests revealed her white blood cell count was abnormally high. A chest X-ray showed a possible pneumonia. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. So her internist admitted her to the hospital, and now she was under my care. I took sputum cultures and blood cultures and followed the internist's instructions, which included starting her on an antibiotic for the possible pneumonia. I went to see her twice each day for the next several days. I checked her vital signs, listened to her lungs, looked up her labs. Each day, she stayed more or less the same. She had a cough. She had no fever. She just didn't feel good. We'd give her antibiotics and wait her out, I figured. She'd be fine. One morning, on 7 o'clock round, she complained of insomnia and having sweats overnight. We checked the vital sheets. She still had no fever. Her blood pressure was normal. Her heart rate was maybe running slightly faster than before, but that was all. Keep a close eye on her, the senior resident told me. Of course, I said. Though nothing we'd seen seemed remarkably different from previous mornings, I made a silent plan to see her at midday, around lunchtime, well before I would normally see her. The senior resident, however, went back to check on her himself, twice, that morning. It is this little act that I've often thought about since. It was a small thing, a tiny act of conscientiousness. He had seen something about her that worried him. He had also taken the measure of me on morning rounds. And what he saw was a fourth-year student with a residency spot already lined up in general surgery on his last rotation of medical school. Did he trust me? No, he did not. So he checked on her himself. That was not a two-second matter either. She was up on the 14th floor of the hospital. Our morning teaching conferences, the cafeteria, all the other places we had to be that day were on the bottom two floors. The elevators were notoriously slow. The senior resident was supposed to run one of the teaching conferences. He could have waited for a nurse to let him know if a problem arose, as most doctors would have. He could have told a junior resident to see the patient, but he didn't. He made himself go up. The first time he did, he found she had a fever of 102 degrees and needed the oxygen flow through her nasal prongs increased. The second time, he found her blood pressure had dropped and the nurses had switched her oxygen to a face mask, and he transferred her to the intensive care unit. By the time I had a clue about what was going on, he already had her under treatment with new antibiotics, intravenous fluids, medications to support her blood pressure, for what was developing into septic shock from a resistant fulminant pneumonia. Because he checked on her, she survived. Indeed, because he did, her course was beautiful. She never needed to be put on a ventilator. The fever stopped in 24 hours, and she got home in 3 days. So when I say, what does it take to be good at something in medicine, what interests me is the idea of asking, what does it take to be good or perhaps even great at something when failure is so easy? You know, we often look to athletes to understand performance, but and there is a lot to learn from athletes about perseverance and hard work and the need to constantly hone your craft. But there are dimensions to medicine not to be found on a playing field. One of them is the fact that lives are at stake, of course. That's what makes the concern about how we do a moral concern. The second is that it's a daunting ambition what people try to do in medicine. We take as our goal that we want to help every single human being in the country have as long a life as possible with the know-how that's available. And this requires consistency and reliability, no matter where people get their care, even if it requires hundreds of people for the care of a single patient, all the nurses who come through on shift, the people who make sure that the lunch tray has no sugar on it for the diabetic person, the people who make sure that oxygen flow is actually working and the right gas, not to mention, of course, the doctors and the nurses who are carrying out the care. And then you add on to all of this another layer, which is that we want people to be humane. We want them to be gentle and concerned for the people they take care of, even if it's millions of people across the country who are looking for help. So it's not just the stakes in medicine that make it interesting, but also the complexity. And that's part of what makes it so fascinating, I think, and at the same time, disturbing. I think a sign of how hard medicine has proved to be is the fact that there is a bell curve. That is, there is a wide distance in results in anything you look at in medicine between those who are the best and those who are not the best. And more to the point, it's a shape of a curve when you look at results where we aren't all grouped at the very best possible results. You know, I think what people imagine that we have in medicine is what I call the shark's tail. That is, we're all grouped towards one end, which are the very best possible results. Because after all, we had, 4 years of medical school and years in residency training and experience and technology. And surely we all pretty much get the same results, except a few laggard, crappy doctors who, you know, we're just protecting and we should cut off at the knees if we knew what we were doing. Well, instead, what you see is something that we have a hard time acknowledging and knowing what to do about in medicine, which is the bell curve, where most of us are grouped right in the middle around a fairly mediocre set of results, very good enough to make sure that we have 97% of people who come through hospitals without any problem with complications, but just poor enough that we see that there is a genuine, meaningful difference at the top of the curve. And I can give you lots and lots of these examples. But the one that interested me the most was the one for cystic fibrosis. And the reason cystic fibrosis interested me the most is because it runs the way we want all of medicine to run. Here is a field. The children have a genetic defect, leads their lungs to slowly fail over time. Their nutrition, they don't absorb food very well. And the result is that they die prematurely. Well, we take care of these children in 117 centers across the country, specialized centers where the doctors have a high volume of experience, which is what we all know you want to look for complicated care. They all participate in clinical trials, and they all follow detailed guidelines, more detailed than we have for most of the rest of medicine. And yet, there's a bell curve. If you look at cystic fibrosis centers around the country, the average patient in the country, and that's what the average center gets, is a 33-year life expectancy for their patients. But if you look at the top end of the curve, it's a 47-year life expectancy, a difference of 14 years. So why, if they're doing it all right? Well, I went to a program that was in the middle of this curve to try to find out. And what I discovered was a place called the University of Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And they were actually just below the halfway mark on the curve. So I went there essentially looking for trouble. What I wanted to know was, what were the problems? And I found a few interesting things. First of all, this was a place with a fantastic reputation. They are routinely ranked in the top 10 of children's hospitals in the country. The oral polio vaccine was discovered there by Sabin. It's the vaccine we rely on for the global eradication of polio. And then even within cystic fibrosis, the head of that program is a man who had devised many of the guidelines that we rely on nationally and even internationally. He's the person who wrote the textbook chapter in Nelson's Pediatrics on cystic fibrosis, and that's the Bible for the pediatricians. And yet, as I said, they're there right in the middle of the curve, not at the top. So then I thought, okay, they got fancy people running at a fancy institution, but maybe the reality for patients is not anything like that. So I went to clinic and spent a day and a half there seeing how the patients were really taken care of. And what I saw was care just the way I would want it. Conscientious people, attentive to the children. They knew them. They weren't making it up that day, because you can tell when people know their patients and when they don't. And also the patients were devoted to them. They'd followed them over their entire lives and felt they were there when they needed them. So what more could you want? A place with a great reputation, conscientious people, well-trained. Well, then I thought, there must be something different at the top. They must have a secret drug. So I went to the place that turned out to have the best results, the University of Minnesota Center in Minneapolis, run by a guy named Dr. Warren Warwick. And they didn't have a secret drug. They were following the same guidelines, following the same set of, using the same treatments, and yet they were getting different results. One possibility is maybe that the children have a less severe form of cystic fibrosis, but it turned out that the likelihood of having the most severe gene was not high, was not lower there. They were as likely as they were in Cincinnati or elsewhere. Could it be socioeconomics, the income of the families there? Possibly. We know from looking at the curves that 25% of the variability can be accounted for by income and demographics, as well as the genes that people carry. But 75% of the variability was not accounted for. And so I wasn't sure really what could make this place different until I went to clinic with Dr. Warwick. And then I began to see what the difference could really be. And I want to read to you from that. In the clinic one afternoon, I joined Warren Warwick as he saw a 17-year-old high school senior named Janelle, who had been diagnosed with CF at the age of 6 and had been under his care ever since. She had come for her routine 3-month checkup. She wore dyed black hair to her shoulder blades, black Avril Lavigne eyeliner, 4 earrings in each ear, 2 more in an eyebrow, and a stud in her tongue. Warwick was 76 years old, tall, stooped, and frumpy looking, with a well-worn tweed jacket, liver spots dotting his skin, wispy gray hair, by all appearances, a doddering mid-century academic. He stood in front of Janelle for a moment, hands on his hips, looking her over, and then he said, "So, Janelle, what have you been doing to make us the best cystic fibrosis program in the country?" "It's not easy, you know," she said. They bantered. She was doing fine. School was going well. Warwick pulled out her latest lung function measurements. There'd been a slight dip. 3 months earlier, Janelle had been at 109% of normal. She was actually doing better than the average child without CF. Now she was around 90%. That was still pretty good. And some ups and downs in the numbers are to be expected. I knew this from looking at the charts in Cincinnati. But this was not the way Warwick saw the results. He knitted his eyebrows. "Why do they go down?" he asked. Janelle shrugged. "Any cough lately?" "No." "Colds?" "No." "Fevers?" "No." Was she sure she'd been taking her treatments regularly? "Yes, of course." "Every day?" "Yes." "Did she ever miss treatments?" "Sure. Everyone does once in a while." "Well, how often is once in a while?" And then slowly, Warwick got a different story out of her. In the past few months, it turned out she'd barely been taking her treatments at all. He pressed on. "Why aren't you taking your treatments?" He appeared neither surprised nor angry. He seemed genuinely curious, as if he'd never run across this interesting situation before. "I don't know," she said. He kept pushing. "What keeps you from doing your treatments?" "I don't know." "Up here," and now he was pointing at his own head. "What's going on?" "I don't know," she said. He paused for a moment. And then he turned to me, deciding to take a new tack. He said, "The thing about patients with CF is that they're good scientists. They always experiment. We have to help them interpret what they experience as they experiment. So they stop doing their treatments, and what happens? They don't get sick. Therefore, they conclude, Dr. Warwick is nuts." "But let's look at the numbers," he said. And all this while he was ignoring Janelle, he went to a little blackboard he had on the wall. It appeared to be well used. He said, "A person's daily risk of getting a bad lung illness with CF is 0.5%. And he wrote the number down. Janelle rolled her eyes. She began tapping her foot. "The daily risk of getting a bad lung illness with CF plus treatment is 0.05%. And he wrote that number down. So when you experiment, you're looking at the difference between a 99.5% chance of staying well and a 99.95% chance of staying well. Seems hardly any difference, right? On any given day, you basically have a 100% chance of being well. But," he paused now and took a step toward me, "it is a big difference." He chalked out the calculations. "Sum it up over a year, and it is the difference between an 83% chance of making it through the year without getting sick and ending up in the hospital, and only a 16% chance." Now he turned to Janelle. He said, "How do you stay well all your life? How do you become a geriatric patient?" Her foot stopped tapping. "I can't promise you anything. I can only tell you the odds." In this short speech, I realized, was the core of Warwick's worldview. He believed that excellence came from seeing on a daily basis the difference between being 99.5% successful and being 99.95% successful. Now, many things human beings do are like that. Catching fly balls, manufacturing microchips, delivering overnight packages. Medicine's only distinction is that lives are lost in those slim margins. And so he went to work on finding that margin for Janelle. Eventually, he figured out that she had a new boyfriend. She had a new job, too, and was working nights after school. The boyfriend had his own apartment, and she was either there or at a friend's house most of the time, so she rarely made it home to take her treatments. At school, new rules required her to go to the nurse for each dose of medicine during the day. So she skipped going. "It's such a pain," she said. He learned that there were some medicines she took and some she didn't. One she took because it was the only thing that she felt actually made a difference. She took her vitamins, too. "Why your vitamins?" "Because they're cool." The rest, she ignored. Warwick proposed a deal. Janelle would go home for a breathing treatment every day after school and get her best friend to hold her to it. She'd also keep key medications in her bag or her pocket at school and take them on her own. "The nurse won't let me," she said. "Don't tell her." And deftly turned taking care of herself into an act of rebellion. So far, Janelle was okay with this. But there was one other thing, he said. She'd have to come to the hospital for a few days of therapy to recover the lost ground. She stared at him. "Today?" "Yes, today." "How about tomorrow?" "We failed, Janelle. It's important to acknowledge when we've failed." And with that, she began to cry. Dr. Warwick's different. And when you see the attributes of someone who's able to take this difficult, risky thing, this human thing we do called medicine, and try to make it work and succeed at it, you see a few attributes that I think are really important and fascinating, each in their own right. One is diligence, the idea of attention to detail, and you saw it in the way he looked closely enough at Janelle to understand the details of how her life really worked, what the barriers in her life were to her succeeding, to his failing to do what he could for her. The second attribute you saw in Warren Warwick and others that I try to describe is a kind of surveillance. Remember that conversation he had with Janelle started with that one measure, the lung function measure. He's been following that for 40 years of his career. And he picked it out a long time ago as something that he would be willing to stick with for long enough to see that he could make it better from one year to the next to the next. And he set a high bar. He wanted that lung function measure to be normal for all his kids. And he wanted it simple enough that he could follow it over time. And you see that in lots of places. Well, another thing you saw in Warren Warwick was that he tried and he found ways to do right despite the obstacles. That visit I described to you was a 20-minute visit. He functions under the same insurance rules that everybody else has, the need to plow people through, lots of people in a day. And, you know, when he has to, he keeps them longer. But he's also the head of a clinic that's been around for 40 years, and it wouldn't be around for 40 years if it didn't manage to turn a profit, make anything in the way of an income. And so he's found ways, despite the obstacles. He has to be creative about it, but he does. And then that comes to the last attribute he had, which is the one that I find makes medicine so worthwhile. It was a kind of bedside ingenuity, a way in which, as an individual, just with some judgment and care, you could figure out things that could actually help people, things that aren't all in the textbooks. And so he looked closely enough at Janelle to figure out that the nurses were not letting her take her medicines or were making it hard for her. And he had that ingenious moment when he said, keep those pills in your pocket. Don't tell her that you're taking your medicines by yourself. And managed to make that into a kind of rebellion so she could do better. Well, he also does this in large ways. I mean, he is just one physician of eight in his group. And if he does really well and the others don't do well, then they're still going to be a mediocre, ordinary group. And so what he wanted to figure out was, how do we get high levels of performance out of everybody? And so even though they're not reimbursed for it, he requires all of his team to spend an hour or two a week sitting down with him and going over all the patients they took care of during the week and explaining what were their problems, how did things go, and what did they do for them. And it's as if, you know, when you go to a doctor, that you not only have the benefit of that one person, but you have the benefit of the whole department behind them, because they would sit down once a week and ask, You know, when you came up against the puzzle, what did you do? Are you doing all the things that we could? He's also been ingenious in other ways. He's let the ideas take him wherever they take him. So when he started his career, the average survival for a child with CF was under 6 years. And then in the 70s and then in the 80s, you were seeing more and more teenagers coming through. And he found new problems. You know, one of the treatments for the kids is that you have to beat on their back in 14 different locations to mobilize all the secretions that glue up their lungs. And you have to do this, the parents have to do this 3 times a day. Well, what teenager wants to see their parent 3 times a day, let alone have them touch them? So he invented a vest, an inflating vest that could beat on their back for them. And that allowed them some degree of independence. It allowed them to get on to college and not have to be tied to the home. It allowed them to go into the work world and live and prosper and be well. It also turned out that the vest often did better than the parents. After all, the vest doesn't get angry. The vest doesn't get tired or annoyed. So he allowed himself a kind of bedside ingenuity. In those attributes, you don't see people who are geniuses. You just see people who are willing to look at their fallibility, to ask questions about how often they fail and how often they succeed, and then to try to think hard about overcoming it despite the chaos of the world, despite the fact that, you know, I work at a hospital with 10,000 employees and most of the time feel like I'm just a cog in the machine. There is an essay that I come back to again and again that I love by Samuel Gorevitz and Alistair McIntyre, two philosophers who wrote in the 70s, on the nature of human fallibility. And what they noted was that there are essentially two sources of fallibility in anything we do as human beings. Number one is ignorance. We have gaps, general lack of knowledge about how the world works in all of its particulars. And then the second is what they called ineptitude, meaning that the knowledge is actually there, but an individual fails to apply it correctly. What's the revolution of our world today? And this is particular to our generation, is that ineptitude is now as much our struggle as ignorance. And the nicer word to put on it is performance is now our struggle. That is, we have this world of knowledge and science that has shown us lots of ways that we can make things better. And there are people out there who've learned how to use that in ways that put them at the very top of the curve. And we have millions of lives, I would argue, that could be saved by understanding and making a kind of study in science of that kind of performance in our daily lives as individuals, but also at the highest level. We are used to putting our emphasis on discovery, and so the NIH has $30 billion. But how much does the one agency that focuses on asking how well have those discoveries actually gotten to the ordinary American? It's an agency called the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research. And they get $300 million per year, a fraction. The irony of our current situation is that there are the opportunities from taking the same decided focus on discovery and applying it to how we perform, getting rid of ineptitude. And that as we look more closely, we find that for all the technology and know-how that there is, in the end, medicine has become more human. 50 years ago, the decisions that a doctor made didn't really matter all that much because there are only a few things a doctor could really do for infectious disease or for, it was little, almost nothing we knew how to do for heart disease or strokes, whole swaths of disease like cancer. Whereas today, even the smallest decision matters. It's the difference between doing better, doing worse. And so we see the power in performance and looking closely at the people that I call the positive deviants of the world. The last thing I'd point out, though, is there's a flip side, a vice versa. That there is lessons coming out of medicine that about how we overcome fallibility despite the complexity, despite the chaos, despite needing thousands of people to all work together somehow. There are lessons coming out from the successes that you see within it that might be helpful for showing us all how we can do better. Thank you. I'd be delighted to take questions. There are a couple microphones. There's one microphone here. I think that's the only microphone, actually.
Hi, I'm a general internist at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Yeah.
And you're making it seem as though if we just tried a little harder, and that we're talking about marginal things. How about the fact that 20 years, it took 20 years after Libby Zion for residency review committees to limit hours and for interns and house staff. And I can tell you where I was, there was tremendous resistance. And all this talk about shift work. Doctors resist things that are obvious to everyone else. And you don't have to do a lot of research. And you don't have to go to the place that does it best. I mean, this is common sense. And even now, instead of getting more people to cover the hours, they try to jigger the system so that the same number of people will do the same amount of work. It's just it'll be divided up a little differently. And it leaves coverage at night much too thin, very inexperienced. And this is not rocket science, and it's not marginal, and it's not best practices. This is common sense. And the profession resists.
You know, I will have failed my job if you finish the book feeling like all people have to do is work a little harder. What you find looking at the ordinary physician, ordinary nurse, ordinary hospitals, people are working a little harder. They're trying really hard, and yet they don't succeed. And a big part of the reason why is we're not used to measuring ourselves and being willing to get ideas from other places and go travel and look and see how they do it. You know, there are and then the further source of resistance is from the fact that the way we do things works well enough that we are threatened by the idea of trying to change it. We are saving lots of lives. We're at a point where the longevity in the U.S. has reached 80 years in large part over the last few years because of how well we can save people who had heart disease who used to all die before, and we can, you know, solve infectious problems and so on. One of the cases I try to make, and it's hard to consider, is that we have to be willing to change and to be early adopters, even if it puts at risk the standing of where we are. When you come to a hospital, I mentioned you have a 97% chance there will not be a complication. But we're 300 million people in the country. A 3% chance is not tolerable when we know that it can be better in certain ways. But to be willing to go for hire requires people adopt change. And it's complex and hard to do, and at times risks making things worse. And the 80-hour work week is a classic example. You know, the idea that we would limit hours to 80 hours of work per week sounds crazy to people out in the regular world, and yet to people inside medicine, we don't know how we can possibly do it. And I'm in surgery. I'm in a field where I myself have deep ambivalence about the 80-hour work week because there's a relationship you have with a patient where once you've cut them open and done something to them, you feel that you need to have the responsibility to be there for them if something goes wrong, no matter the time of day, no matter if it's a weekend or not. But we also know that we have to be willing to rely on others as a team if we're not going to be so tired out that we don't do a good job for people in the first place. And so we're, you know, working with ways to make sure that you don't have gazillions of people changing shift every 8 hours and no one knows what's going on and you have connections that make it work. But our failing is we never look closely enough to ask, well, what was our complication rate before we tried the 80-hour work week, and what's our complication rate after? It's because most of us don't even know our complication rate to begin with.
I work for a healthcare research firm, and actually following on a point you just made on tracking survival rate, we looked at a New York study a few years ago on CABG at New York hospitals.
On bypass surgery for hearts, yeah.
And what the study did was measure the survival rate of the hospitals and found that for the most part, and this is a very quick anecdote, I apologize, but for the most part, it was within a very predictable statistical band. But there were a few outliers. If you looked at Manhattan, for example, I believe Lenox Hill Hospital was the best hospital. I mean, it beat what could have been predicted as statistical, whatever it's called. But Lenox Hill was the best hospital in the state. And then there was another hospital on Manhattan, the worst hospital outside of the band. So we thought that was interesting and went back, and I think New York did the same study a few years later. And lo and behold, Lenox Hill still beating the average. Mm-hmm. This other hospital still lagging. But as you've talked about the problems with patients and physicians enacting practice on the bell curve, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on the implications of the bell curve, because what we found in terms of acting, Lenox Hill, you would think they were the best, their volumes would go up. No, they lost dozens of CABG procedures. This other hospital, they doubled their CABG procedures over the same period. So why can't we take, even when there is transparent information, why don't we act on that? Why don't patients and physicians insurers?
It's a great question. You look at Consumer Reports, and why did people still buy the cars that were not getting the great ratings? It's the same question, because and it boils down to a couple of things going on. Number one, you know, the results for cardiac bypass surgery in New York were made public in ways that the names of the hospitals, the names of the surgeons are all now available on the web. And that's a remarkable difference from almost all but three other states. And what you see by their doing that is that they actually have better results overall than in other states. There's lots of argument back and forth about whether that program of making it public was a good idea or a bad idea. But the sharing of information in that state led to a tighter curve. The places that were really falling off, that were well below margin, they were mostly smaller hospitals doing too few a year to do them well, and they dropped out. And you've seen that in other states where they shared that information. There is still going to be a bell curve. You're always going to have a bell curve. And that is the other part that's hard for us to grapple with in medicine. You know, what if I turn out to be average? And it's hard for other patients to contemplate and think about. Now, part of the reason they don't shift around is that when you've had a heart attack and need heart surgery, you're not usually in a position to feel like you want to shop around. And the other aspect is that the cardiologists who suggest go here or go there are often slotted in by insurance networks that keep you from moving people around very much. And so there are obstacles to getting people to the good care. But and then lastly, you'll have lots of arguments back and forth because you ask the cardiologists and the surgeons whether they believe the data, and they don't. They look at the numbers, and they see nuances that don't make complete sense to them. And so the folks at Columbia will say, Lenox Hill, come on. And so, you know, what I think the mistake is that if we look at these curves and say, well, it's consumer choice and let the market do what it will, you know, the reality is as a heart patient, you're not going to be able to just pull out the book and say, I'm going to go here. Instead, what you want is people comparing notes enough to say, okay, let's go to Lenox Hill and ask what they're doing differently and what they're not. I don't believe the data, but I have to believe it long enough that after 5 years, they're still coming out number one, they're doing something. And try to then figure it out.
Well, my daughter is 27 and has had intractable epilepsy for 7.5 years, meaning her seizures persist. And initially, after a lot of testing, she was not considered a candidate for surgery at one of the best places. But almost a year ago, after more testing, they considered her a candidate for surgery. So what we as a family have been trying to determine is what is the best place to go to, trying to define for ourselves what does best place mean. Beyond the analytical research and comparing, one good friend says, well, trust your gut more, you know, and another good friend says you got to be able to know you've done a pretty good job and let go. Look for outcome comparisons between doctors, surgeons, hospitals, and it's really not available very well. So I just thought I'd ask, yeah. Any suggestions, or is it time, do you suspect, to trust my gut and let go?
I think you've asked a really important question, because in one way or another, we all come to the same one you have, but perhaps not as dramatically as with your daughter. And what you've come up against is a couple of things. I would love to know who the best surgeon is in my own field. You know, I joined my practice 3 years ago, and I know I'm not at the top of my bell curve. I'd love to get there someday, and I'd love to know who really is the best. But all I know, I find out the same way you do. Who has the best reputation? That's about all I can go on. Mm-hmm. And so I visit the ones who have the best reputation, and I learn things from some, but others I wonder why they have that reputation. Mm-hmm. And what you've come up against is that just as there is an art to being a doctor, there's an art to being a patient. There are times when you have to be willing to push, to ask for second opinions, to look and Google whatever you can find on folks, and sometimes even get angry when things aren't going the right way. And then there are other times when you have to be willing to let go and put yourself and your family in the hands of others whom you know are fallible, but that you trust they're doing the best they can and aiming for everything that you could hope for. So when do you draw that line? There is no great answer. You've done all the footwork. You know enough to have reached a range of choices where there are people that you can generally trust. And then choosing among them, your two friends are probably right. You go with your gut and try to make the best of you can with the decisions that fit together. And you start weighing in things like which is closer and makes it possible to be there for her, because that matters too. All of that comes together, and it's perfectly all right to weigh in things like your feel walking in the door and talking with that physician, or your sense of whether you can be there and accessible and not having to go all over the place. That's the difficulty of where we are today, though. It's not just the doctors who have to struggle through these questions. It's everybody.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
My name is Rob. I work for RespirTech. We manufacture kind of the third generation of Dr. Warwick's vest or high-frequency chest compression.
Yeah, he's mad at you because you guys aren't paying him patent money.
Not sure about that. I go to a lot of hospitals and clinics throughout the U.S., bringing our system to CF facilities. Yeah. I encounter in some places still a real resistance to that type of treatment. Sometimes it's we just don't want to have two units, or we don't want to have to clean it, or just kind of people going with the thought that what we're doing is good enough. What would you have for advice for someone in my position to kind of compel them to at least try this new technology?
One of the things that people often will ask is, I've got this obvious thing that should be done somewhere, and they won't do it, right? And all of this run across this in our lives. Part of the reason people don't do it is because they don't think you know their world better than their world, and it's hard to step into their shoes and try to see that things the way they do. But the other reason is because there's no way that they are themselves tracking how they're doing when they do it one way as opposed to another way. And as I mentioned to you, there's a resistance to change in medicine that's legitimate, because when things work well and you've got a system that's comfortable, you only tweak that system with some nervousness. You know, I do a lot of thyroid cancer surgery. I do about 200 of these a year. And I've gotten a way that I do it, and we've gotten down to a less than 2% major complication rate, and I only reluctantly will consider changing that. But you do have to figure out how to get people to the position of changing their mind about change, and part of it is by seeing what the bell curve is like. Well, the world in cystic fibrosis changed enormously in November, and that was when the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation made public all of the results for every single center in the country. If you're a center that's at the top of the curve, I guarantee that the centers in the top 10% are probably doing things very differently. They've worked it out, what the local particulars are to make things go well. But if you're approaching a center that's in the middle, towards the bottom, then they need to be thinking about trying to change and looking to see if something pushes them up that curve. And who knows if it's what you have to offer them, but there's something they've got to be thinking about how to move forward. Let me take this last question.
Hi, thanks. I'm an oncologist at an institution a little bit north of here, Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
And I was a little bit intrigued by a paradox in your talk. You started out by telling a very personal story about a resident who went back to see a patient. Probably that small act of conscientiousness would not have shown up in a large study of outcomes on survival. And yet the rest of your talk focused on numbers and survival and talk, where maybe going back to the patient that you talked about, she probably would have survived either way, even if that clinician had not gone back, and you wouldn't see that on a bell curve. So I'm fully in agreement with you about the idea of outcomes research, which is a major interest in our institution. And what we've learned is that even though doctors are conscientious, it takes quite a community to kind of make that difference as a society, as a community. It takes patients and nurses reminding doctors and kind of taking out the hierarchy and maybe telling the outcome story at the bedside, comparing the two stories that you told, doesn't show what a community it takes to make that big change. Sorry for the long question.
No, but it brings a great point. There is some unmeasurable component to greatness in what people do. Some sense in which there's a little margin that you've gotten for someone that, you know, is just not going to show up in statistics necessarily, especially when you're doing a variety of things in the course of your career and you only take care of, you know, a few people in the end of day. And yet, we see wide differences that are large statistically that that fit into the picture. And so what I would tell you is they both fit together. There are small things that people who are very effective what they do day in, day out as part of what they do. And you learn something from them, little tricks, little pearls. But then there's the bigger pattern. We have 40 million people we operate on in the country each year for surgery, inpatient surgery. It's a ton of operations. We have about a 3% major complication rate for hospital surgery. Surely we can learn something from those who are at the 1% level and change for hundreds of thousands of people how things turn out. And so we, as individuals, have to think about the minutiae, and as a society, have to be willing to look at the bold changes that are possible. Thank you very much, and thank you for your time. Great.
Atul Gawande talking about his new book, Better. Thanks for joining us. To hear more readings like this one, go to npr.org/booktour.